Ready? Okay, so Mr. Robertson, if you could introduce item 18.
Yes. Item 18 is an informational item and provides background on erosion control issues for construction sites in the stormwater program. Julia Dyer will present a brief overview of our construction stormwater regulatory program, focusing on the scale and magnitude of erosion issues, types of erosion problems, and regulatory risk analysis used to determine which requirements apply, types of management measures to control erosion, and our implementation efforts. And as you can see, we've kind of paired these two items right next to each other. Same pollutant, different regulatory programs because the location of the source is different here. So we'll take a look at how construction stormwater regulates sediment here.
Good afternoon, Chairman Wolf, members of the board. It's a pleasure to be here again. To some of you, I am a new face. My name is Julia Dyer. I'm an environmental scientist. And until approximately 9 years ago, I was before you regularly as the Timber Harvest Program Lead. Now I'm a member of the Stormwater Unit, where I'm the Construction Stormwater Lead. Today I'm going to provide you with an update of the Construction Stormwater Program with a focus on erosion and sedimentation issues. Can you hear me better now? Okay. Before I get into the presentation, I'd like to point out that all the photos in the presentation were taken at construction sites within the Central Coast region. The Construction Stormwater Program is a successful program. It's been in place for 27 years, and the success of the program can be attributed to multiple factors. The industry has matured over that 27-year period and has extensive experience with preventing erosion and sedimentation. The Stormwater Program is a permit-based program. It's based on the Construction Stormwater General Permit, or CGP, which has clear and authoritative requirements for the prevention of erosion and sedimentation. Additionally, the permit requires a risk-based approach, which involves each project being run through a prioritization or risk determination during its enrollment phase to assess its potential threat to water quality. Additionally, the program is supported by an effective and efficient electronic reporting system. The permit also requires site-specific plans to plan in advance for erosion and sedimentation. And these plans are required to be developed by key personnel on the project who've already been through a certification and training process. The program also allows for and promotes interagency coordination. And the Central Coast Stormwater Team for Construction takes a prioritized approach when implementing the program. The team is comprised of 4 staff members plus a scientific aide. It's 2 geologists, 2 environmental scientists, and our scientific aide. That's our scientific aide there at one of the sites, Mary Karens. Appreciate a lot of the help she gives us. Additionally, 2 of us on the team voluntarily went through the certification and training process for the same that the regulated community needs to do for developing the site-specific plans. But what I'd like to point out to you is that although there's 4 full-time staff members assigned to the construction stormwater program, they don't work full-time on the construction program. Our part-time efforts that are divided between the construction, industrial, and municipal stormwater programs lead to 1.5 PYs of personnel devoted to the construction program. The construction permit regulates construction activity of 1 acre or greater, and applicants must enroll the project under the construction program, the construction permit, prior to breaking ground. Currently, I estimate there are about 667 projects enrolled under the permit now. But all of those projects could be at any phase of a construction project, from initial enrollment prior to breaking ground all the way through completed construction and final stabilization, at which point they request from us to be released from the permit. And I put this photo in here because it demonstrates the temporary nature of construction projects. The majority of facilities that we regulate are permanent. Like, for instance, just borrowing from the other programs in the stormwater unit, an industrial facility, we plan on that being there for years, if not decades. But a construction project is meant to be temporary, hopefully starts in the spring and ends before winter. Some last longer. But as you can see in the site, once it's graded and is what we call open, it's vulnerable to the erosion and sedimentation we want to see prevented through meeting the requirements of the construction permit. But going back to how many projects are currently active in the Central Coast, I estimate approximately 500 acres of active construction, which would equate to about 300 projects. And our projects, there are bigger projects, but they average between being 1 and 2 acres in size. If we see one larger than 2 acres, that's more rare. Additionally, we see a net increase. Over the last 5 months, we've seen a net increase of about 2 projects a month between the ones that newly enroll and ask to be released, but the number is variable over time and depending upon the economic conditions. So this presentation, much like the permit itself, is focusing on erosion and sedimentation. These photos are a quick reminder as far as what is erosion and what is sedimentation. Erosion is sediment leaving the site, like you see in this photo on the left, and sedimentation is the sediment entering surface water, like you're seeing on the right. What you see on the right is a river that, when full, flows the direction of the blue arrow, and the red arrow is showing a sediment plume from a construction site entering into that waterway. Now, as I mentioned before, the construction program is a risk-based program. The permit requires that each project go through a risk determination at enrollment. The risk is determined by 2 factors, potential sediment risk and receiving water risk, and I'll explain in more detail how those 2 factors relate to each other and lead to a final risk determination, which is 1 of 3 levels. And as the levels go up from 1 to 3, the potential threat to water quality goes up as well. So this is the first of the 2 factors shown in that first slide. Potential sediment risk, that is based on the revised universal soil loss equation, and it's based on 3 factors that are multiplied together, which provide an estimate of potential soil loss in tons per acre from that site, and they're divided between high, medium, and low. And just to give you an idea of how much soil could potentially be coming off a project, five tons of topsoil spread over an acre is a dime thick. So a low sediment risk project would have the potential soil loss of less than 15 acres, or 15 tons per acre, excuse me. And I'd also like to point out, this isn't how much sediment we're expecting to leave the site. This is how much sediment we're hoping that they'll keep on the site by complying with the permit. The factors include rainfall erosivity, which is a factor that takes into account the length of time the project is open. It gets a higher number if it's open over several winters. Also soil erodibility and a length slope. So a project that's open for a long time, has highly erodible soil, and is large and steep is going to get a higher potential soil loss in tons per acre. The second factor is receiving water risk. This is listed as either high or low, and it's based on whether the project is located in a sediment-sensitive water body or in a water body that has aquatic habitat beneficial uses. And I said or. It needs to be one or the other, and then it's considered high. And approximately 90% of the watersheds in our region are considered high for receiving water risk. So the way these 2 factors combine together to pick a level, if you have a project with a high receiving water risk and, let's say, a medium sediment risk, then you would match it from here to here, and it would be a level 2 project. That's how the permit determines risk. The successful implementation of the program by the Water Board staff can be attributed to several things. One, as I mentioned before, it's a permit-based program, which has very clear requirements. We're supported by an electronic tracking system, which is maintained by State Board. The tracking system tracks the project from enrollment through all the reporting requirements all the way through completion when the applicant files what's called a notice of termination that we need to review and approve before they're released from the permit. We also rely on interagency coordination, and again, we would do that with local agencies at almost all phases of the project. For instance, during that notice of termination phase, I make it a habit to call the local municipality, let's say it's the city of Watsonville, and I'll ask them, this project's being asked to be released from the permit. Are you having any problems with this program or with this project? The local municipalities are aware of all the construction sites in their municipality or their jurisdiction, and that strong communication helps us keep them accountable because it doesn't happen often, but does happen where the municipality will say, well, no, we have them under enforcement, and we want you to hold them to the requirements of the permit before they resolve these given issues, and it's a way for us to have each other's back and stay in communication on what's going on out there. But we do conduct our own inspections. As I mentioned, with 1.5 PYs, we do have limited resources, but we conduct approximately 20 inspections per year, and our inspections are based on our priorities, because again, with 300 active projects, we can't inspect them all like we would like to. And our priorities include risk level, project size, the proximity of that project to a water body, and if the project has a history of non-compliance. Additionally, we have a nice problem, which is with the program being nearly 30 years old, most people are aware of these requirements, and so we get complaints from neighbors or folks that otherwise know what the requirements are to complain about what they're seeing out there. And for instance, my jurisdiction and my assignment area is here in Santa Cruz County, and unfortunately I can't drive up here every time I get a complaint because it's a full day of travel even to get up here and back. So that's where we would rely on our strong relationships with the local municipalities. I would call the local municipality, I'm hearing about this project, what's going on out there. As I also mentioned, there's a requirement with the permit for there to be trained, certified professionals on site. I can call them, ask them what's going on. And most of it can be cleared up through some calls and emails. But we filter these complaints through our prioritized system. And fortunately, the regulated community takes these requirements very seriously. So we're able to correct the majority of them at the phone call email level. But if we have a more serious issue of one of the sites, we can issue an NOV or an ACL or any of the regulatory tools that you are all familiar with. But I wanted to take some time to talk about best management practices and what we look for when we are on inspections. The primary thing that we're looking for on inspections is that the sediment on the site is staying on the site. And so, yes, we do see sediment basins. Those are used often, but we also like to ensure that those are used as the last line of defense, not the only line of defense. So we like to see what we call redundant BMPs. So, for instance, on a project, we want to see these silt fences, vegetated area, erosion control with these fabric socks, and hold the sediment site and not make the sediment basin work too hard. Another thing we like to see is if you have a large site, maybe grade it for as much as you can develop and not grade the whole site first and then start developing it, because the more the site is open, the more it's vulnerable for erosion and sedimentation. A second example where we like to see construction implementing best management practices is at the track out. That's another point of vulnerability on a construction project. So here's an example of a project where they're not doing a good job on their track out. You can see that sediment has made it out into the street. They do have those plates there. They're called shake plates. They're meant to shake the sediment off tires, but if they don't maintain them properly, then they fill up and then they stop functioning. The second photo is the same driveway post-construction, and you can see the stark difference. Not only this demonstrates the amount of sediment that can leave a site through a track out, but it also demonstrates how once a project is complete and released from the permit, like this one is, it no longer poses a risk to water quality because it's paved over or the landscaping is in. I wanted to talk a little bit about the types of noncompliance that we see when we're out on inspections and implementing the program in general. In addition to reporting violations, one of the most common noncompliance we see is improperly implemented best management practices, or BMPs. And in this case, you see a straw wattle laid on a impervious pavement to protect a storm drain inlet. Straw wattles are not effective on impervious pavement. They need to be trenched into soft ground before they're effective. So this is really doing nothing. If anything, it might be putting some straw into the storm drain inlet where it wouldn't have otherwise. So this next photo represents the second type of issue that we see most commonly, which is improperly maintained BMPs. So what you see on the right is a straw wattle that was keyed into soft ground, but it wasn't maintained properly, and now it's flat. And I took that picture the day after a storm event. So they didn't update it prior to a storm event. We would consider this a violation. The straw wattle on the right should look more like the brand new straw wattle on the left. We do see from time to time discharges to surface waters. This is a photo or a set of photos regarding a discharge to a surface water 2 winters ago. This was a self-reported incident of a failed sediment basin. That's the sediment basin on the left. And on the right, you can see the plume of sediment coming out of that area and into the nearby waterway. Staff issued this project a notice of violation and worked with the project managers to make sure that this wasn't repeated again and that the water course was protected through the remainder of the project. So in conclusion, as I mentioned, this is a successful program. We're successful at seeing the regulated community prevent erosion and sedimentation. Surface discharges are rare, but when they do happen, our enforcement is effective, which leads to water quality protection. That concludes my presentation. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
So start with my right. Any question?
I don't really have questions. You made a very good presentation, and with the longevity of the program, it's good that you kind of pointed out that over time, programs become embedded and understood, and municipalities and county staff and so forth are all kind of operating from the same page.
Yes.
And that's really encouraging because that's what we anticipate, you know, happening over time with our programs as they change. But I do know that with stormwater in particular, we have had some, proper word, not necessarily increase, but we've changed in the our understanding of best practices. And so I'm curious how those get implemented when changes in best practices occur. Are you working with the industry itself, or is it just that the regulations are shifted and people are expected to keep up with it? Have there been changes in the technical best practices guidance?
Yeah, the overall answer to that question is yes, and it is also very site-dependent because each project is going to be having its own issues and its own challenges. But we do have a coordinated group of people, especially through the certification process for best management practices, where the industry can communicate with each other and with us as needed. Usually we hear about it most often once it becomes a problem, so we'll work with them to see that the problem is abated. But, I've seen it evolve over time, and they're learning how to implement things more satisfactorily. Did you have something you wanted to say?
Yeah, I would say that probably the bigger area of innovation with stormwater management is in the post-construction structural measures to actually deal with the project once it's built and responding to the rainstorms that are going to happen from there, that point forward. But those have had implications for how they deal with the temporary disturbance during construction as well. And so we have worked with, you know, the industry and the dischargers on a variety of, you know, approaches to dealing with that, primarily by putting out some regulations that promote it, but also by providing technical assistance on loan pack development and right. measures like that.
Right.
I think one of the pictures that Julia showed you was a picture of a large sediment basin that had failed
mm-hmm.
and actually resulted in a discharge. That sediment basin was being used as a temporary sediment basin during construction, but its long-term fate was that of a post-construction retention basin.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the areas where we have a learning curve, you know, where people are trying to figure out how to do both, provide for that longer-term protection in the post-construction setting, but also deal with the temporary disturbance. It's difficult to make that work, and in that case, it didn't work very well. So, but it's an example of the learning curve, and I think people are starting to figure out the ways to phase those things.
Oh, that's interesting. That's very important. And you mentioned the certification. I'm glad you brought that up. I had a thought about that that I hadn't noted for myself. But once certified, is that a renewal? Does it have a shelf life, if you will? Do they have to get certified periodically, or is it just a one-time?
Well, I'm one of the staff members that got the certification, so I can answer that personally. It depends upon, and I blew through a lot of, I avoided a lot of acronyms for this presentation, but the certification process is called QSP-QSD, which stands for Qualified Stormwater Pollution Prevention Plan Developer and Practitioner.
Can you say that backwards?
I'll have to practice that. That is involving a one-time exam that you take, and then it's an annual fee after that. So then it depends upon your underlying certification. So for me, it's a certified professional in erosion and sediment control, and that does require ongoing educational units for me to maintain that. And if I do lose that underlying certification, I would also lose the QSP-QSD. Other underlying certifications are being a professional geologist or a professional engineer. You're a professional geologist. Does that require an ongoing educational units to maintain?
Actually, it does not.
Okay.
Just an annual, just the fee, periodic fee. But to become a QSD or a QSP, I actually would have to go online and, you know, kind of meet some requirements.
Mm-hmm.
But my underlying certification or geology, professional geology license, lowers the bar for me to become a QSD and QSP.
Mm-hmm.
That's correct.
Yeah, I was impressed that you were able to have two staff go through the industry certification so that there's a – I think that just strengthens communication and, using language that's, inherent in the certification itself as well as technical and scientific language. But I think that just creates a common platform. So that
you're correct. It absolutely does.
Yeah, I was pretty impressed by that. So good work. Good work, guys.
I'll move on my left, starting with Mr. Young.
Okay, thank you. So something kind of flew right over my head with this, and that is, I thought that although there's a general permit, I thought that this was being implemented through the municipalities. Aren't they managing this more directly with each of these construction sites?
Yes, you're absolutely correct.
Okay.
There is a component of a construction management through the municipal permit, and that speaks to that relationship we have.
Right.
Because if we and I didn't mention this in the presentation, but let's just say, for instance, we had a municipality that was not doing what they're supposed to do as far as making sure that construction projects were being protective of water quality. Through the municipal permit, we could then take enforcement on them and say, and we have done this, we could enforce on the municipality and say, you're not enforcing the construction requirements. And all counties and cities have their own code enforcement for these types of things. So it's very multi-layered.
Okay.
So if they're dropping the ball on that, there's a lot of different regulations we can point to saying you're not doing your job.
So that's what I thought.
Yeah, and you're correct to think that, yeah.
Yeah, and
there's one wrinkle there. I want to make sure you're clear that we have a permit for these individual construction sites. We issue a state permit, or they enroll in a general permit. So we can regulate them directly independently of any interagency cooperation with the local agency.
So,
but you're right, the MS4 permit allows us to require that the cities provide that extra layer of oversight.
So there's more than one kind of permit here then, right?
Correct.
But they're different permittees, right? There's the construction permittee, the person who's building the project.
Okay.
And they enroll under the general permit.
And the residential that also is going to do construction, that's going to fall under?
Any construction site that's over an acre. So anything below an acre is not going to be enrolling under the construction general permit. But the local municipality will be all over that site because they regulate per their requirements under the MS4 municipal permit.
And you guys aren't addressing that component with this presentation?
No.
No, only projects an acre or greater, and I might have failed to mention that.
And on projects that are smaller than an acre, when you apply for a construction permit, you go to the building permit department of the county.
Correct.
Providing all your drawing, civil engineering, mechanical plumbing, etc., you have to have a erosion control component in your construction documents. If they're not sufficient, they'll be red marked by the city or the county saying insufficient, and then they also make specific reference to some of the narrative associated with the requirements. So, you know, augmenting a little bit your answer, that's the process.
And one of my favorite things about this program is that all of the municipalities make a requirement that if your project is over an acre, they won't issue your grading permit until they provide proof that they've enrolled under our construction permit. So it's very nicely linked together.
Thank you.
Next.
I have to comment. Thank you for the presentation.
Mr. Johnson?
Okay, so if I've got it straight, if it's under an acre, you have a construction stormwater element to your municipal or county permit. If it's over an acre, you have that same element in your municipal or county permit, plus you're required to get a permit from us or enroll enroll in an order, I guess?
You enroll under the permit. That's a general permit.
Enroll under the permit. Okay. And now, when you talked about the I forget what it was called, the revised universal acronym for erosion risk or something.
Correct.
The first element in that was rainfall erosion potential. It was slide 8. One more. Yeah, there you go. The R.
Yes.
So that's rainfall runoff erosivity, and you referred to that as the time period that the project was going to be open. Is there also a factor in that R that is the average rainfall or the in that area, or does it vary by rainfall in an area, or is that just a number?
It does. So the way this factor is calculated is there's this ICO rodent map that the applicant needs to locate on a map that has been pre-calculated. I don't know. I didn't bring the ICO rodent map with me, but it's calculated about factoring in exactly that. What type of erosion are we expecting?
What type of
see?
Rainfall, basically?
Yeah, exactly. Dependent on rainfall, and it's going to be a higher number in a higher rainfall area.
Got it.
And then, like I mentioned, also the length of time and the time of year. A three-month period over the winter isn't the same as a three-month period over the summer.
And the other thing I'm just curious about, you referenced when you talked about coordination with local agencies, that if you got a complaint in Santa Cruz County, you might rely on local jurisdictions to back you up. And I'm always a little sensitive as somebody from the far reaches of the region compared to the San Luis Obispo office. So would that be handled differently? If it was a San Luis Obispo complaint, you might run out and take a look at it. And if it were your area, and if it were a Santa Cruz complaint, you might rely on the local jurisdictions. Is that kind of how it works?
No. it's tempting to do that, as you know, it's down the street, but both John Robertson and Dominic talked to all of us on staff to not try to not suffer from the shiny object syndrome, where it just, like, it sounds like it might be a big deal and it's only a mile away. Let's go look at it. We still want to run things through the filter of our priorities, because if we did that, we could be kept busy with all the complaints just in our local area. So we filter it through our priority system, and then we'd do the same thing as I would do in Santa Cruz and call the local municipality and ask them what's going on.
Let your fingers do the walking.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's all I've got. Thank you.
Mayor Delgado?
Thank you. Can you talk about beneficial projects, if they're treated any differently?
You mean like, this happens rarely, but for instance, we had a project where it was an RCD doing a clear out of invasive vegetation in a riparian area, but it was greater than an acre. Is that what you're talking about? So in those cases, they still have to enroll under this permit. They would still have to comply with all the requirements. So I guess in that case, we don't treat them differently, but they're also not creating any additional impervious areas like another project would. So I think that the only way it would be treated differently is it would be considered lower priority. As far, I wouldn't rise to the one of the 20 inspections that we conduct over the year, all things being equal.
Do you have is there any kind of a waiver option?
Yes, there is a waiver option, and that's for projects that are smaller than 5 acres, and if their rainfall erosivity factor, like being displayed now, is smaller than 5, they can enroll in a waiver.
Okay.
But not, it's not based on the type of project?
No, it is not based on the type of project.
I think I want to make a point about restoration projects. We have one, for example, in San Luis Obispo County that involves a type conversion and some landform grading to bring back to a better condition. But there's still disturbance there, and there's still exposed soil. And if something happened to the funding or to the ability to implement that project to completion, it's subject to the exact same risks. I mean, depending on the risk level, but it'll be comparable in its risks. And so I don't think the permit doesn't provide for any alternative exceptions or waivers, but as Julia said, we are not going to necessarily prioritize that project if we think it's moving forward at a good pace. So,
and when you say you don't prioritize it, what do you mean?
I mean that if that we aren't going to put it on the top of our list of inspections for evaluating compliance, it's primarily annual report reviews and inspections.
All right. So whether that's building a Taco Bell or doing a habitat restoration, it's a matter of size. If it's more than an acre but less than 5 acres, and it's a matter of the erosivity factor on how you treat it, whether it gets a waiver or not, not because it's a good thing or
right.
a for-profit venture.
Precisely, and that's baked into the permit. It's if the numbers crunch out that they meet the waiver, they can enroll for the waiver. Incorrect. If it's a Taco Bell, they get the waiver if their erosivity factor is less than 5 and they're less than 5 acres.
And if there's a project permitted for that discloses a time of construction as part of this erosivity factor, and then you have a dry year, is there ever a need or request by the permittee to change that? Like if they were supposed to be done by November, but there's no let's say November 15th, but there's no you're in a dry year and there's no rain predicted. Do you ever adjust the allowance of activity outside of the originally permitted window of time?
Yes, that happens frequently. So during the enrollment phase, the applicant needs to state when do they expect to break ground and when do they expect to conclude the project. And those are the dates that go into this R factor. And let's say the project's going along and they're not going to meet that timeline, they're required to go into our system, change the end date, and recalculate their risk level.
So they wouldn't change the start date in that case. The start date is still when they started. The start date doesn't renew at today's date, where it's dry now, and it's just you just change the end date. Is that
correct?
What you're saying?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Mr. Young, I think you had one follow-up.
More question. So, is this the same staff that then regulates or oversees the less than 1 acre size projects under the municipal supervision?
In part, the unit has 4.7 PYs.
Right.
Four and a half full-time people. So the idea is to distribute the work among them. And at this time, there's two staff that don't do any municipal permit implementation. Three do and two don't. So they're exclusively working on industrial and construction permit oversight. The other three staff, two of them, are exclusively working in municipal oversight. And one person, Julia Dyer, is covering all three. So she has her foot in each of the permits. And that's actually been more typical of the staff workload in the past, is everybody does a little of each. But as time has gone on, I've seen some advantages to sort of limiting the focus of a couple of the staff to different programs.
So if we were to compare the 667 projects that we're talking about right now versus the number of projects we have less than 1 acre, which represents more acreage?
Well, we don't track projects that are less than an acre. That's what the local municipalities do, and we would talk about that with them during a municipal audit.
Do we know how many projects?
No.
That they have at all?
No, I
at
don't.
At any one time?
Well, we require them to track that.
And report at the end of the year.
Only reporting the new projects that are subject to post-construction requirements. So there's a lot of other projects that aren't going to come through.
So tell us about your oversight of the municipalities so that we have confidence that you know that they're doing what they should be doing.
Okay, well, the municipal permit, the phase two municipal permit addresses 37 of our municipalities, and a phase one permit for the city of Salinas addresses the other. And they have very explicit requirements under a provision called the construction program oversight provision. And through that provision, they have to identify the number of sites and inspections and the frequency and all that with regards to their own oversight. In the examples where we have found deficits, we've actually pursued enforcement and seen incredible response and improvement where we've looked for it, where we've asked for it. But in general, most of the phase two permits are phase two permittees are quite competent in this regard. In fact, it's one of the things that they're stronger at in general. We see occasional deficits, but our approach is to monitor their annual reports for that particular provision, the reporting on that provision. And then through the audits, as Julie mentioned, we will at times look at the post-construction element. Sometimes we don't include that in a municipal audit because it's such a large permit.
Do you audit all 37?
Yeah, over time, like roughly on a five-year rotation.
Okay.
Can I provide you with an example?
Sure.
So the way audits go is in the morning we discuss the various components of the municipal requirements, and then the afternoon we do field inspections. And so what I would do for construction is in the morning I would have them provide us with a list of active construction projects in their jurisdiction, particularly ones that are the less than the acre category. And I say, well, let's go out there, and I want to observe you inspecting a site, and I want this to be someone who inspects regularly. And I've reached the point, it's changed my brain, being in this project. You know, I look at construction sites and I can see where they need to be making improvements. So I'll step on the site and silently see what I think needs to be addressed. But I say nothing. I let the inspector go through their process and see that they're pointing those out too. And then if we don't, we discuss it. Why didn't you bring up this or this? And we work to make sure that we're we're sharpening each other's skills and that they're on the ball. And sometimes they're not. And when they're not, like Dominic said, we take enforcement, we list it in their NOVs, and then, yes, we do inspect them approximately once every 5 years. But in the cases that have happened where we don't think the inspectors are sharp enough, we'll come back the following year. We'll put requirements in their NOV that all their inspectors need to be trained and know how to do this. And the following year, we want to see to it that they've been proved.
You know, just a parting thought is that with climate change, you know, this is really going to be important because we're going to have, you know, storms of some higher intensity from time to time. And so these erosion control devices and VMPs are really going to be critical. And it's going to be important for municipalities to be on top of, you know, these smaller projects to make sure they're properly implementing these BMPs.
Correct, yes.
So, you know, I personally had an experience with the city of Santa Barbara a few years ago. I know Dominic knows about it because we had talked a little bit. Just one block from my house, you know, residential construction site. And I was just watching the BMPs and the fiber rolls not really being installed properly and not functioning the way they should be functioning. Yeah. You know, it did cause the city to, you know, look at what they were doing a little more carefully because there was a water board member sitting on top of them. But I could see that, you know, might be an important thing to keep on top of with all the others.
Wasn't that all precipitated from runoff from your property?
No, this is one block over.
It's Friday afternoon. Yeah. I can do that.
Active construction site. You know, moving a lot of earth around.
Absolutely.
You know. So anyway, thank you very much. Great presentation.
You're welcome.
So as a wrap up, you know, from my perspective, also very nice, concise presentation. Appreciate that. One quick question: most common violations. What would it be?
Not preparing properly for storm events. And another thing I didn't mention is that all of the permitted projects are required to develop what's called a rain event action plan prior to a storm. And so I've learned that the best time to go on inspections is the day after a storm, because usually if I go in the summer and I point out problems, they'll say, well, if it was about to rain, it wouldn't look like this. So going out the day of or the day after a storm takes away that excuse. It really gets their attention. But, yeah, I think they get focused on the project, and it's kind of easy to overlook these kinds of things. So we have to make sure that they know we're out there and we're looking after them, and that they need to prepare in advance for the storm events, because that's the critical time.
Okay. So then just an observation, and I don't know if you ever gotten feedback, but – you know, silt fencing, often by the folks who are involved in erosion control and installation, refer to these as street ornaments. And the reason they do is that when you have a windy day, quite often, if you don't set the stakes correctly or, you know, soft ground, they'll fall down.
Absolutely.
If you have a heavy storm event, they're useless. So folks such as the RCDs, for example, often that's sort of the lingual used. I know they're part of a standard, and you know you see them, but it has a lot more of a feel good feeling than actually being effective. Just as FYI.
Yeah, I've observed that myself, and they are constantly installed incorrectly. They're used more of maybe like a perimeter fence to define the perimeter of the project rather than to physically stop erosion, and we chronically have conversations with them about that.
Yeah, that's why we call them street ornament.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so thank you very much.
You're
Appreciate
welcome.
So this wraps up these items.